Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. And today we're headed to Downey, a small city about 12 miles southeast of downtown LA on the 5 freeway. And here's something you might not know about Downey. It was the first stop on America's quest to get to the moon, which took place 50 years ago this week.
It's like a visitor center.
The capsule that transported astronauts directly to the surface of the moon and back into Earth's atmosphere was designed and built right here. And a replica sits outside the Downey Space Center.
There's a little mock-up, right?
That's a boilerplate.
Yeah.
That's a legit capsule.
Benjamin Dickow looks at that model and harkens back to a time when thousands of people were hard at work at this place. Dickow heads up a museum that teaches people about the Apollo program and all of the capsules that were designed and made here.
The final construction was right in front of the front doors in Building 290.
Well, that's a 24-hour fitness.
That's on the footprint of Building 290, 24-hour fitness. So if you walk in there, work out, you'll know that the ship that went to the moon was built on that property.
Now, aeronautics workers had built aircraft in Downey for some time. The small city played a key role in equipping Allied forces with planes and parts during World War II. After the war, North American Aviation, or NAA, began operating in Downey and employed thousands. And aviation and aeronautics were booming in Southern California at the time. Firms like NAA weren't just focusing on planes, they also turned their eyes to the space race. The Soviet Union, remember them? Well, the Soviets successfully put a man into space in 1961 and a satellite into orbit. And the U.S. had to play catch-up.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills.
That's President John F. Kennedy in 1962. Within just a few years, the city of Downey would take off even higher.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Rocket scientists in Florida and elsewhere, and engineers in Houston helped make it possible. But the design and construction of the capsule that would house the astronauts was awarded to workers at North American Aviation in Downey.
Everything you see here, this was all the facility, like bigger than Disneyland. There's a huge, huge amount of space.
How many people worked here at that time? We're talking late 50s, early 60s.
At the height of the Apollo program, 35,000 people worked here.
35,000?
It's a city. It was a city in itself. It was 24/7, three shifts a day, constantly, constantly people in activity.
And we're talking engineers, aeronautics engineers, people who were not only thinking about construction of this, but the math and science that goes into how space exploration works.
Absolutely. However, a huge majority were just blue-collar technicians who could build stuff with their hands.
Those 35,000 people built everything, from the actual capsule itself to the devices and the electronics that went inside. Engineer Chuck Lowry designed the parachute system that, at the tail end of the mission, guided the astronauts safely back to Earth.
You know, all of the designers on Apollo, and there were thousands, they're all sitting on the edge of their chair, and they're so relieved when we get down. But, of course, in my case, the game has just started. I have to get them home.
Lowry is in his late 80s now, but he remembers how important his part was and how relieved he would be when those glorious plumes of gravity fighters opened up perfectly and that capsule floated down into the Pacific Ocean, 900 miles southwest of Hawaii.
And when the main chutes came out at about 10,000 feet, that's when we all say, we're home. And the astronauts go nuts when they look out the window and they see those beautiful parachutes above them. And you get all these superlatives like beautiful, gorgeous, amazing. And all the crews were just elated when they saw the parachutes come. And then it's a soft ride down to the water.
I can see it in your face, though. Like, I can see, like, the pride in the success of this mission, right?
Yeah.
Another engineer, Nathaniel Levert, shares in that pride. He was working on an early satellite system for Douglas Aircraft when Downey called.
I tell you, I would have worked for nothing because I was just so fascinated with working and what they had me doing. But I was surprised that they would turn over something so I considered so important to do analysis and design a system to pressurize the liquid oxygen tank.
That was your job.
Yes.
That liquid oxygen was important in the function of the main engines. There's no oxygen in space, obviously, so those engines needed liquid oxygen in order to combust.
And we did a lot of testing. And finally, we were getting the results we wanted. And so they said, okay, this is what's going inside the liquid oxygen tank. I couldn't sleep that night when I was thinking that they're going to fly. So it flew on every flight, every S2 flight.
Nathaniel Levert is now 85. At the Downey Space Center, he shows us the designs and calculations that he hand-drew and tabulated in the 1960s during his time in the Apollo mission. And for our tour of the Space Center, he was reunited with an old friend.
My name is Shelby Jacobs, and I'm known most out of my 40-year career for the putting together the system for the cameras that took the famous separation of the interstage on the Saturn program.
Now, Jacobs' camera system would be one of the first ever to take pictures of the curvature of the Earth as rockets separated from the capsules that they thrust into space. And while Shelby Jacobs and Nathaniel Levert say they are super proud of everything they accomplished and helped bring about in the modern space program, it wasn't all that easy for them in the workplace. Remember, it was the 1960s, and they're both African-American. America may have been at the forefront of the space race, but was still struggling with the human race here on Earth.
The environment was a hostile environment for us my entire career. I never had a job that had been preceded by a black before. Every job I had for 40 years, I was replacing a white person. And if I moved on, I was replaced by a white person. So it was like putting your finger in a glass of water and wondering where the hole went. So there was a certain resistance to us because we were taking jobs that were previously allocated for white males. Females were subject to the same thing.
That's another story. Yeah.
That's another story, but it's very similar.
Yeah.
And I saw females break barriers just as we were.
Nathaniel Levert is from Alabama and was working there during the Apollo 11 mission. He remembers when he couldn't even dine with his colleagues.
In Huntsville, that was the guys wanted to go eat. It was about 18 of us that went down to support the flight. And they were talking about going to this place. And one of the guys said, well, wait a minute. I don't think Nate can go there. And that was true. I couldn't go.
You couldn't go.
But I told him, I said, don't worry. Listen, I'm from 80 miles south of here, and I grew up like that. I know about all that stuff, so.
Even here in Southern California, there was segregation. Shelby Jacobs says he couldn't even live in Downey at the time.
For the same reason segregation happened in the South, it was here too. We could not live where we wanted to live. That time, in the 50s, most blacks lived in Watts. Our segregation was what I refer to as de facto. There was no law that you could see that said you couldn't do these things, but it was just kind of known that if you were black, when I came to work here, all the blacks who worked here had to come from Los Angeles to other areas. Even though we went to the same bathroom, we couldn't live in Downey.
Today, Jacobs and Levert are celebrated as two of many heroes of the Apollo program in Downey. And they say the future of space exploration will continue to amaze. Look what's happening on the other side of L.A. at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where scientists are overseeing the mission to roam and dig deep into Mars. For the up-and-comers who have the skies in their eyes, engineer Chuck Lowry offers some advice. Don't forget all of those hands that contribute to such monumental things.
I always encourage young engineers, go out in the shop, spend time out there, sit there and watch them machine apart. Watch them when they assemble this. Watch them when they torque the bolts and touch it, and then you're a better designer.
Machining parts and torquing bolts, just like the work they did decades ago here in Downey. Well, let's continue our journey into the final frontier and take a look at the current state of the space industry right here in Southern California and even beyond. Matt Kaplan works for the Planetary Society, and he hosts Planetary Radio. Matt, thanks for being here.
It is a pleasure and an honor, Steve. I'm a longtime fan.
Well, same here, same here. In our trip to the Columbia Memorial Space Center in Downey, which you just heard, we did hear from some of the engineers who were crucial to the Apollo program 50 years ago. What about today, Matt? Is Southern California still important in the aerospace industry?
It is still extremely important, though there has been an evolution. A lot of it, of course, comes from our prominence in, you know, before there was such a thing as aerospace, there was aeronautics. And you had so many of the major companies, especially gearing up for World War II, basing their factories in Southern California, in Downey, in Long Beach, in Huntington Beach, and elsewhere. And so it was kind of a natural transition to go into space. But it is still playing a huge role. A lot of this has to do with the rise of commercial space, where you still have the great companies like Northrop Grumman, Aerospace, the old line companies, but you also have the rise of companies like SpaceX, right down the road from you guys, where they are building all kinds of rockets in Hawthorne. The Falcon 9, the Falcon Heavy, which I just saw launched a couple of weeks ago. It is an amazing transition for the program in Southern California.
I think what distinguishes the space program today and the aerospace industry in Southern California as opposed to what happened 50 years ago is that a lot of these companies, you mentioned SpaceX, these are private companies. This isn't NASA. They have a NASA contract, but they're private companies. It's not the government.
That's right. It's a new paradigm, and it's one that NASA is still in transition to, still adapting to. But the new NASA administrator, relatively new, Jim Bridenstine, he's very committed to these partnerships with commercial companies. And SpaceX is now almost becoming an old line company because of the appearance of these new companies like Vector and Rocket Lab that are based down in Huntington Beach, which are coming online with smaller rockets. And then there's Virgin Galactic, which is getting ready to maybe put a satellite in orbit later this year. A lot of smaller companies building smaller rockets, taking advantage of advances in technology that make it much cheaper to do this.
You know, I think one thing that a lot of folks don't realize, and I was having conversations about this over the past couple of weeks, is that we've been to the moon since July 1969, right? That wasn't the only time we went to the moon.
That's right, yeah. And it wasn't just us. It hasn't been just us. I mean, right now, as we speak, China's little lander, the second one they put on the moon, is crawling around on the far side of the moon, a first for anybody. India was supposed to launch its Chandrayaan-2 orbiter, lander, and rover yesterday, but that's been delayed. They had to scrub the launch yesterday, but that may be happening anytime. And it was only, what, 2-3 months ago that we saw Israel come very close to putting its Bereshit lander on the moon. And now there are all these new NASA contracts in a program called CLPS, Commercial Lunar Payload Services, that are funding much smaller companies to build landers on the scale of that Bereshit lander and take all kinds of interesting payloads to the moon in preparation for putting humans back up there.
For putting humans back on the moon, I think the Trump administration has made it clear that they want to go back to the moon, but as a jumping off point to Mars, which some people get confused about. I mean, what is the next step for NASA to put another human being on the moon and beyond?
Well, there's a lot of skepticism about this. Of course, the Trump administration and the NASA administrator have embraced this goal of 2024, getting humans back to the moon in about half the time that it took the Apollo program to achieve that once President Kennedy put us on that course. And there are a lot of steps left to complete. The big new rocket from NASA, the Space Launch System, which will be the first rocket to come close to equaling and eventually surpassing the old Saturn V rocket, has fallen behind and is pretty far over budget. They are making progress, but that is something that still has not flown and will not fly for a while yet. A little bit farther along is the Orion capsule, which Boeing is the prime contractor for, and that is looks a lot like the old Apollo command module, but it's quite a bit bigger, and it is designed to be part of the core of what could be a mission to Mars eventually.
I know the Trump administration also wants to establish a sixth branch of the U.S. Armed Forces, calling it the Space Force. What role do you think it would play in defense strategy and in space exploration in general?
Another very controversial subject, and one that you're finding the now Democrat-dominated House, of course, is also pretty skeptical of. There are a lot of people who believe that from a defense standpoint, space has not been getting the attention that it deserves, primarily from the Air Force. But there are, the skepticism comes out of the belief that, you know, maybe the United States doesn't really need a completely separate new arm of the military. It would be expensive. And really, there isn't that much to do. There's a lot of military use of space, but is it worthy of its own independent division of the military? So there are a lot of people pushing for a space command to remain within the Air Force, but to get a sort of new emphasis, new priority to make sure that it gets the attention that it deserves. As for space exploration, that would pretty much stay with NASA. Any new form of space command or a separate space force would be pretty much devoted exclusively to defense. And there is recognition that space is going to be an important place for the military to have a presence. It has been for many years with communications and spy satellites, of course. Spy satellites going back to the 1950s and are absolutely vital to not just our military, but the militaries around the world.
What are you most excited about when it comes to space exploration in the coming months, years, decades?
Well, speaking only for myself, not for the Planetary Society, there is so much to be excited about. I would love to see, I've said to people, I don't just want what is commonly referred to as boots on Mars, humans on Mars. I want a shoe store on Mars. I want to see humans on Mars, if not living there permanently, at least at the level of, let's say, you know, a research station like we have in Antarctica. That's something that my boss, Bill Nye, likes to talk about. But there are so many great things happening on the robotic side. We've got spacecraft all over our solar system and more to come soon. I mean, we're only about a year away from the launch of what is still known as the 2020 rover. It'll look a lot like the Curiosity rover that's still very active on Mars right now. But this one, the 2020 rover, will be actively looking for signs of past life on Mars. And that is pretty thrilling. And then not too many years later, we're going to send another, basically a mission to search for what might be signs of life out to Jupiter's moon Europa. That's the Europa Clipper to be launched in probably the mid to late 2020s. They're building that at JPL right now, not far from where they're building the 2020 rover. So there's a lot to be excited about.
Matt Kaplan, who works for the Planetary Society, he hosts Planetary Radio as well. Always excited to talk to you, Matt. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
It's a planetary goodbye zone. Say at the speed of Chiba. Oh, you are not gonna diva. Maybe I have to get high to get by. Yeah.
Well, just ahead, back here on Earth, city councils in Orange County are getting more factionalized. Why those councils are making it a higher jump to get things on the agenda? You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Well, in most California cities, if you get voted onto the city council, you get to put issues that you think are important on the agenda for public discussion, maybe even a possible vote. That's certainly why a lot of folks get into public life in the first place. But a number of cities in Orange County have decided to change some rules to limit what some council members call grandstanding. It's Monday, and Gustavo Arellano is here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So what are we really talking about here? What are these new rules that are being put in place in some OC cities?
So the general rule, and it's really a new wave of this rule, is that if you as a council member want to put an agenda item for discussion within the council during a council meeting that the public can then comment on, now some cities want at least two council members to say, yes, we agree with the person who wants to put it, the council member who wants to put it on the agenda. And in the case of one city, Westminster, you need a majority of the city council to put anything on the agenda.
Irvine is the latest Orange County city to do this. You're mentioning that other cities have as well. Which ones are we talking about?
So the biggest one is Anaheim, by far. Anaheim is the biggest city in Orange County. So with the new mayor, newish mayor, Harry Sidhue, he moved to have that put onto the city council earlier this year. The other city is Westminster. Westminster, there, that you need the majority of the city council to put agenda items now by a council member. And in Garden Grove, it's interesting. In Garden Grove, if you want an agenda item voted on, then you're going to need at least two other council members to say, yeah, you could do that. But if you just want to bring something up for public discussion, you could still put it on the agenda like basically almost any other city in the United States.
Well, I mean, because that's what I think I'm getting at here is the fact that, you know, I mean, that means you have to have all this kind of backroom dealing in order for somebody to sort of jump onto your bandwagon. Is that what it is?
That's exactly what it is. And it's really a reflection of our political times, factionalism, petty politicians, and those cities that we mentioned, Irvine, Anaheim, Westminster, and to a lesser extent Garden Grove, they have been the scenes of vicious bickering between council members over, well, in some cases, over the past decade. So what you're seeing now are these council majorities who are really paying retribution to council members that they don't like by making it that much more difficult for those council members to bring up items to, and remember, this is not items that maybe you want to pass or that council member wants to pass. Sometimes they just want to discuss items because the public, their constituents, and say, hey, we want you to discuss this in your role as a council member during a council meeting.
Did any council members, Gustavo and Irvine, vote against these new rules? Did anyone object?
No, it was completely unanimous, but there would have been one council member who would have voted against that, Melissa Fox, a Democrat, because really this new rule was geared specifically against her. The other Irvine City Council members have been upset with Melissa Fox because she's trying to bring a very contentious issue, and we've talked about this before, putting a veteran cemetery somewhere in Irvine. She wanted to bring that up for public discussion, and during Pride Month, she wanted to also bring up whether the city should put up an LGBT pride flag in front of Irvine City Hall. And for whatever reason, the current council as it is, they took great offense to Fox even trying to bring that up. So
were there any people, citizens who were there who were vocally against this?
Oh, yeah, a lot of people. So what's in Irvine, it's actually temporary. So they have put this to be in effect until January 2021, when you're going to have a new council after the 2020 elections. And then at that point, they're going to decide, do we want to scrap it? Do we want to make it permanent? And really what's going to happen, this is not some lofty attempt to make this new sort of democracy. If you have a council that is against this, then they're going to scrap it and say, no, like we should do it like almost any other city. If you're a council member and you want to put up a discussion item for on the agenda so the public can hear it and so the council can discuss it, we can. And whether this is going to happen in other cities in Orange County remains to be seen. But really what you're going to see, if you have more councils like Irvine, Anaheim, Westminster that are at war with each other, once you start getting these majority, that they will use their power to silence the minority. And to me, that's not democracy at all.
Gustavo Arellano, our Orange County Lion. By the way, if you were looking for the podcast Orange County Line, OC Line, which we've had for many years on KCRW, it's now included with the Greater LA podcast. So wherever you get your podcast, check it out at Greater LA. Gustavo Arellano, thanks.
Gracias.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, a trip back in time through pictures of your favorite rap and hip-hop artists. That's tomorrow. It's The Business with Kim Masters next on KCRW. Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, and Christian Bordahl. I love those folks. Thank you for your support. I'm Steve Chiotakis, back at it tomorrow. Thanks for your ear and for your time. We'll be back tomorrow.